me speak to you about the anatomy of terror.
It was said of him, I think the Daily Variety, that he could produce a film in a phone booth for the price of a call to New York and complete it before his 3 minutes were up. Roger was fast.
As a young filmmaker, I was watching every type of film I could find. But for the Poe films, I studied the work of Alfred Hitchcock and of Ingmar Bergman, plus some of the German expressionist directors of the 1920s.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are The Rance Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of The Rance Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
So we're back to talk about the Edgar Allan Poe cycle.
Yes.
The Roger Corman films for AIP back in the starting in 1960
yeah.
with House of Usher. And we covered House of Usher last episode, and we gave some background on AIP. You should listen to that one first before we dive into this, because there's going to be a lot of back and forth references to mm-hmm. the material we've already talked about. But I was thinking how the Poe cycle, particularly, it's even in terms of the aesthetic, they're a great counterpart to the Hammer horror series.
Yes,
when they started tackling the classic monsters, and actually, interestingly, because they didn't have the rights to the original Universal Monsters, they had to tweak things and sort of skew stories a little bit here and there.
Change people's names,
yeah,
you know,
so,
as you do.
I guess eventually they did get the rights, and so the story started looking a little bit more like the original Universal.
Right.
I think The Mummy in particular, but they made a bunch of Dracula movies. Christopher Lee and mm-hmm. Peter Cushing were the Hammer duo. In this case, it's all about Vincent Price in the United States, you know, Poe cycle. And I take some pride that there was, like, equally good work being done here in the United
yeah.
States. And I guess even more pride that, like, these were made on a shoestring budget.
They totally were. And I think something to think about when we think about the difference between AIP versus Hammer
mm-hmm.
is that Corman was really coming from a very, almost like a high art
yeah.
view of it, which Hammer mm. was really coming from. I mean, they're great films, and don't get me wrong, but they're literally coming from, like, the dregs idea of just gore horror.
I had always loved the, quote, European art films, particularly the work of Bergman, Fellini, Truffaut, a number of others, and the somewhat classical look that they brought to their films, particularly the works of Bergman, influenced me greatly.
Corman has talked about expanding these stories and using the short stories as a sort of third act to
right.
arrive at.
So we're always finishing up with the Poe. You know, we're kind of always
right,
finishing
right.
with that idea.
Yeah, so it becomes more authentic as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the uses of the short story that we found, particularly as in The Pit and the Pendulum, which was only the story of the man with the pit and the pendulum, was to use Poe's story as the third act, as it were, of the picture. And then we would create the first two acts in a way we thought would be consistent with Poe's vision to lead us into the final act, which would be his story. I hope that Edgar Allan Poe would be proud, pleased of what I've done with his works.
Speaking of the writing, this next movie, The Pit and the Pendulum, was adapted by Richard Matheson, who should be a familiar name. Relevant to this episode, he wrote a number of the Poe cycle,
mm-hmm.
including the aforementioned House of Usher, and Pit and the Pendulum, Tales of Terror, and The Raven.
Dick Matheson was a very well-known and respected science fiction and horror writer. He had also written The Incredible Shrinking Man. So based upon his novels, which I had read, and The Incredible Shrinking Man, I simply hired Dick to do the Poe pictures. He was one of the best, if not the best, writers I have ever worked with. As you know, you get a script, and then you start rewriting it. And then you go to the second draft, the third draft, and then you're changing and doing all of these things. Dick Matheson's work was so good that I could go into pre-production on the first draft.
Matheson was a seminal novelist and screenwriter. He's worked on some hugely influential set pieces like the book I Am Legend, which was first adapted for Vincent Price in the film The Last Man on Earth. Your dad, I remember, is not a fan.
No, I love that book, though. I'll tell you, I love that book.
It holds up enough so that they want to remake it every couple of years.
Yeah.
He wrote some classic episodes of Rod Serling's Twilight Zone. He adapted a bunch of his own short stories for film, including Steven Spielberg's first feature film for television, Duel. A bunch more of his short stories have also been adapted, including Hell House, What Dreams May Come.
Really?
A Stir of Echoes.
Okay, I'll take that.
And Button Button, which was first made into a Twilight Zone episode. And a few years ago, it was done by Richard Kelly of Donnie Darko fame. Mm-hmm. He retitled it The Box. That one did look good. It was sort of a quiet release. It starred James Marsden, Cameron Diaz, and Frank Langella. And the same core original idea. It's just kind of fun that his ideas have made it this far. They're kind of timeless ideas.
I mean, you can definitely say that about something like I Am Legend, you know, and it gets its Omega Man spin, and then it gets the Will Smith version. But it works in any time.
So on to the Pit and the Pendulum. From 1961, written by Richard Matheson, starring Vincent Price, John Kerr, who was mostly a TV actor, who did westerns and lawyer shows.
Yeah, western lawyers, whatever.
Also starring Barbara Steele.
Yeah, finally. Where was she?
It's always fun to see her rise from a crypt.
You know, but I spent a lot of this movie, three things I was waiting for. And I'm watching the movie, and I definitely enjoyed it, but I kept being like, where's the pit? And where's that pendulum? And where the fuck is Barbara Steele?
Yeah, they kind of hold her back. It's interesting that Vincent Price is the face of all these movies. And for the most part, you don't get a second heavy. Mm-mm. But she plays that part pretty well.
Yeah,
in this.
Yeah. When she finally shows up, it's well worth the wait.
Yeah. So a brief synopsis. In the 16th century, Francis Barnard travels to Spain to clarify the strange circumstances of his sister's death. After she's married the son of a cruel Spanish inquisitor. That would be Vincent Price.
Yeah, who is the cruel Spanish inquisitor and the son of the cruel Spanish inquisitor.
He's the one who's married Barbara Steele. Again, is it May-December relationships? Is that the expression? I don't remember which month's pair.
Is that May and December?
Old guy,
I think so.
Young lady.
Yeah, I think that May-December is fair.
I think...
see it. Like, Barbara Steele and Vincent Price would make very good-looking children.
I agree. I'm always a little skeeved out because it kind of does reek of like child bride.
I don't know
how long they were together, but
well, let's go back and think about Poe being 26, marrying his 13-year-old cousin.
So
let's
Was she 13? Is that right? I forgot.
Yes.
Okay.
She was 12 though when they first started all living together. Just so everyone knows.
And then treated her mom kind of like his mom, right? That was that was aunt slash mom.
Yep.
Okay. All right, Poe. All right, rein it in. So this is the second of these stories to begin with relationships that relied on correspondence because the guy's showing up to sort of figure out what's going on.
It's not like they can
it's
call.
It's a recurring idea. Yeah, that's a good point. And I guess even letters at this point were sort of tricky to get across country. This is the 16th century.
Right. You can tell by all the neck frills. Tons and tons of them.
Yeah, it feels like they went a little overboard.
I thought so too, right? I was watching it and being like, what's going on with these costumes?
Especially considering their acting approach. You know, they're trying to sort of do like classic stage acting, but it's not exactly like, you know, true to the period. The language is far more colloquial.
And one of my favorite things is like John Kerr comes over when he first introduces himself and he's like, I came from England, and he's talking like you or I right now.
I wish to see Don Medina.
I'm sorry. Don Medina is not receiving visitors at present.
You will announce that Mr. Francis Barnard has come from England to see him.
And I'm just like, I don't think you did, sir.
I swung by New York on my way there and spent months getting rid of my accent.
I'm working really hard at it. The other thing, I text you, I think, like right after or during while I was watching it. And John Kerr does this sort of William Shatner light kind of speaking style that I cannot tolerate.
Yeah.
It's really annoying.
I could... I could see it working on television in the 1960s. But yeah, it doesn't. It's not one of the things that ages
well. And
then
the doctor starts doing it. When John Kerr has a scene with the doctor, then they're both doing it to each other, and you just want to be like, let's get these finished, you know? Like, finish your sentences, everybody, because they're both doing it.
Yeah, they've got scenery hanging out of their mouth from chewing it.
So much stopping and starting.
I guess we saw one before this, but we didn't talk about it too much. But, like, all these films have dream sequences and or skewed flashbacks, affected flashbacks.
It's because Corman was so obsessed with Freud. He was really into it. And we know that Poe obviously was interested in, like, Goethe and philosophers like that. So Corman was like, we're going to have flashbacks and dream sequences and everything. This flashback is really cool.
A lot of gels, a lot of color transparencies.
Going on.
Yeah.
The flashbacks use a wide-angle lens, and it's on blue stock that then was toned red. So that's why you have blue highlights and red shadows on the film.
Wow.
Then they ran that through an optical printer to reduce the brightness of it and then fuzzied kind of around the edges. So it gave us that really skewed kind of look. But it was nothing was haphazard on accident or anything. It was very specific to achieve these blue and red highlights.
That's wild. We're going to keep talking about them because these dream sequences reoccur. But the amount of work it took to acquire those looks, I'm surprised that, like, time was allotted to do this. Because, you know, these were made in 2 weeks on average.
Right.
And, like, those processes are expensive and time-consuming.
I think it speaks to the planning that everything had, you know. Because let's think about the budget. This is around $300,000 budget for this film.
Okay.
Vincent Price got $125,000 for this film.
Oh,
so the rest of it had to pay some of the other actors and then all this processing and this multi-processing of film.
For the flashback or dream sequences in the Poe pictures, I did a great deal of planning. Those shots were sketched out in great detail. I was using special filters, gels, sometimes distortion lenses, combined with a lot of optical printing. Afterwards, we would sometimes go in to the lab 3, 4, 5 times to get different layers of color distortion and diffusion.
So we mentioned that Vincent Price was a contract player, and it sounds like he was doing pretty well by AIP. Mm-hmm. That said, this role might be one of the tougher ones to sell in terms of, like, where the character goes.
Who are you?
I'll buy whatever he sells. His descent into madness is actually, I think it's really great.
I did like it. I was going to get there that he sells it well.
Yeah.
Considering, I don't want to go into spoiler territory, but they certainly drop hints and pieces early on, and we arrive at the sort of logical conclusion, I guess, over time. And Vincent Price, like, it wouldn't, I don't think it would work with anybody else doing that role.
No.
And I don't know, I was very impressed. Usually, you know, Vincent Price could easily, say, like, in The Mask of the Red Death, he's still a charming villain.
Right.
But there's never anything that's, like, too ham-fisted or too, you know, nothing in too strange a demand of his character. This is a little different. This, he has to go to some pretty strange places, and he does so happily.
I like to think of him because as I was watching it, you know how I'm, like, really good at Pictionary because I can give you the big overall view? I feel like that's how he was acting. So you instantly, like, see, like, a little tiny bit of it, and you're like, oh, that's craziness. Like, oh, that's this or that.
Yeah. You see it in his face, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he's giving it right to you, and there's no other, like, what's he thinking? I clearly know, looking at Vincent Price, what he's thinking, what he's trying to portray. You know, I think he's really great.
I'm going to torture you, Isabella. I'm going to make you suffer for your faithlessness to me. Before this day is out, you will be begging me to kill you, to relieve you of the agony of hell into which your husband is about to plunge you. Harlot! You will die in agony. Die!
For this, we return to the theme of being buried alive. And we've talked about how it used to be done by accident. And people would have enough of a trend that people started deciding, it's like, you know what, we should probably tie a string right. to their toes.
And I think you kind of think and assume that's where vampire lore comes from as well, is people kind of being awake. Yeah.
Rising from the grave, if they're lucky. I mean, because otherwise, yeah, I mean, I want, you know, they're probably shallower graves in those days, just probably. In case. If only to save the grave diggers' work.
Yeah, Jesus.
The set is actually pretty cool looking, considering mm-hmm. the low budget. There's a great villainous lair when they do eventually show the pit and the pendulum. Yeah. It's a combination of, like, great set design and mat work.
Yes.
So it gives it this, like, broad scope. It still looks pretty good.
It looks great. When you think, too, it's actually huge. That pendulum is huge.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
blade, it's 18 feet long.
Wow.
So, I mean, this set is huge, and the way that it's seamless with the three-dimensional set versus the matte paintings are really beautiful piece of work.
Yeah, and they don't overdo it. I think they show it just the right mm-hmm. amount where you kind of go, wow,
yeah.
and then they get to the horror.
Yeah.
Returning again to the theme of being buried without being dead, we've got 1962's Premature Burial. This one is a screenplay by Charles Beaumont and Ray Russell. It stars Ray Milland from M is for Murder and X, the man with the X-ray eyes, which Corman
you just recently
made.
Watched.
Yeah, I did. I liked it for the most part. It doesn't go where you think it's going to go.
Okay, fair enough.
And it does end really well. It's a good ending. But so Ray Milland was sort of stepping in for Vincent Price. And so for that, we're not going to dwell too much on this movie because we're kind of going Vincent Price heavy. but so I mentioned X, the man with the X-ray eyes, was made the following year in 63. And I just want to call to attention the workhorse that Roger Corman was. Roger Corman made 9 movies in 1957. He made 5 movies in 1958. He only made 2 movies in 1959. He was slowing down. 4 movies in 1960. And throughout the era, he was making the Poe series. He was averaging about 3 movies a year still. Way above Hollywood standards
right.
these days.
And, like, how long did it take to finish World War Z? Like, forever.
Yeah, before reshoots, even.
Exactly.
Yeah. Also stars Dick Miller. I mentioned earlier the AIP actor who had a hard time finding work outside of the AIP studio system. But Dick Miller is the familiar face from Gremlins. He's the guy mm-hmm. who drives the tractor, and they drive the tractor into his house. But he starred for Roger Corman. He was in Bucket of Blood, the Little Shop of Horrors that they filmed in 2 days and a night.
Nice.
He's a grave digger in Premature Burial. He was in The Terror. And he was also a small part in X, the Man with the X-Ray Eyes. It's just fun to say.
I
keep having that. Yeah.
You just keep saying the whole thing.
I kept writing it because it's so much fun.
We're also joined with Hazel Court, who's another Corman player. We see her in Mask of the Red Death, The Raven, Premature Burial. We see her quite a bit. And she's always a beautiful face to look at.
Yeah, we talked about Corman having a great eye for starlets.
Yeah.
That, he cast some beautiful women for these roles.
And she's like the smart, pretty woman. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. She always is the smart, pretty lady.
So, quick synopsis for Premature Burial, as if the title didn't give away a lot.
Someone goes to a shopping mall.
An artist grows distant from his new wife as an irrational horror of premature burial consumes him. And so that's kind of my frustration with the movie. It is a little one note.
Well, at least the title tells you what you're in for. It's not a surprise.
Yeah, and for that, like, this would have made a very good installment in the anthology Tales of Terror
mm-hmm.
that we'll talk about in a couple minutes. In this case, Ray Milland's character, Guy, is obsessed with the idea that his father might have been buried without having been dead.
Which is a thing to keep you up at night.
How did your father die?
Catalepsy. You know what that is? When it strikes, the victim gives every outward sign of being dead. But he's not dead. He's alive. I was barely 13 when my father was stricken. Doctor said it was a heart attack. There was a funeral. And he was sealed in this vault. That night, I heard him crying out. A pitiful, desperate cry. I begged with them. I pleaded with them. He's alive. He's alive, I said, but no one would believe me.
Because it wasn't true.
It was.
Guy is obsessed with the idea that his dad had catalepsy, which is a real thing, actually. It's a nervous condition characterized by muscular rigidity and fixity of posture, regardless of external stimuli, as well as decreased sensitivity to pain. And so that, you know, if your eyes are closed, it kind of gives you the appearance of being dead.
Right, and that's what happens to her and Usher.
Right.
That's what she also suffers from.
Yeah, It was going around.
Must be convenient.
It's funny that it has a couple noticeable continuity errors, and, you know, it's kind of unavoidable when your shooting schedule is 2 weeks and you're kind of rushing through everything. But that said, the ending is worth it. I thought it arrived at a really dark place. I really did dig the last 15 minutes or solid.
That's so sad to say, though.
Yeah.
Then skip to the last 15.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if it
was Vincent, no Vincent Price.
I might have been glued to it if it was Vincent Price, but it's not. It's Ray Milland, who's serviceable. He's just no Vincent Price. Next one up is the anthology that's a little more fun, Tales of Terror from 1962. The screenplay adaptation was done by Richard Matheson, based on short stories by Edgar Allan Poe. They use Edgar Allan Poe's stories, Morella and The Black Cat, which is combined with another Poe tale, The Cask of Amontillado.
Amontillado, dude.
Amontillado?
Yeah, because when I started watching this, I was like, but I think this is Cask of Amontillado. And then it kept happening, and I was like, but I'm confused. I got really confused, and I had to like look it up and say, like, what is this story really supposed to be? Because they just played mixy-matchy.
Right.
Which was fine. I love Cask of Amontillado. It's one of my favorite things.
Yeah. So that one, Morella, I wasn't wild about. The Black Cat is kind of what we're waiting
Morella,
for.
Yeah, it's fine. It's very similar to Usher. You know, so I'm not really interested in it. I did like that there was a bunch of tarantulas in the house. There was like big tarantula and lots of cobwebs, and they were in Boston, though.
It comes into the dream sequence.
Like legitimately on the table or something. And it's just like, but I'm in Boston. What is happening right now? It doesn't matter. I just thought it was silly. I thought it was really funny. And in my notes, I said, mommy was a mummy. And I said, 26 years, that's gross. So if you watch the film, you'll know what I was talking about. So enjoy that. Let's talk about Black Cat.
And what is it that happens just before death, which leads inexorably to that death? Our second tale provides one roguish answer to that question in the story of a man who hated a cat. The Black Cat.
Let's talk about Peter Lorre.
Yes.
Who, I guess I know more of like people doing an impression of Peter Lorre. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Casablanca, but that's about the only movie. I guess he's an M.
Yeah.
Honestly, I haven't seen it. That's shameful. But he's such like a, you know, we talk about Vincent Price being a company player. Peter Lorre embraced these roles. He also comes back for The Raven. And in both, he's kind of playing like a surly, snarky kind of shit heel. He's kind of a dick.
He's really good with Vincent Price, though, because Vincent Price is very like a very sort of sharing actor. Mm. Peter Lorre is more of a taker, but the two of them together are excellent.
I did notice the amount of reaction work that Vincent Price loves to be in scenes with Peter Lorre and just react off him.
Exactly. And this is one of those like The Raven that was turned into a comedy. A sort of horror comedy.
Yeah.
But this shit was hilarious. I was laughing so hard. Vincent Price is so funny. He's the funniest guy ever. He plays this wine taster. Or he's a guy who can taste all the wines. He knows what everything is by tasting.
Yeah, I guess he's an early sommelier. And Peter Lorre is just a sort of common drunk who it turns out that
is
like,
really good at this too.
After decades of being drunk, he's got quite a few opinions about wine.
Exactly. And so to see the two of them together, because Vincent Price is playing, you know, this really fancy character, and he does the funniest wine tasting faces.
Yeah.
And I love them. Every time he did it, I was laughing. I couldn't stop. And Jackson, my husband, was just like, why do you think this is so funny? I was like, I don't know.
So you would think that they would be antagonistic towards one another, one being a sort of amateur drunk and the other being a sort of highfaluting, you know, fancy pants.
Mm-hmm.
But they become pretty good friends. Laurie has him over to his house with his inexplicably young, gorgeous wife.
Yes, don't quite understand. And she puts up with a lot of garbage, too. She's the only one who works. Peter Laurie is a drunk who does not work, doesn't do anything.
Spending her money.
Yeah, and he's like bullies her into taking the money.
Yeah, this dynamic, I mean, the natural assumption would be that, like, very rich guy, kind of bought himself a wife straight up cash.
Yeah, but no. She's like the breadwinner of the house. She has a cat, which I made a note. I thought, like, if you were that cat actor, that would be a terrible day at work for you because Peter Lorre is so mean to that cat. All they do is throw things at the cat and push the cat around.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. I feel really bad for that cat actor.
So I guess it starts to rear its head, the idea that Peter Lorre recognizes that his wife is out of his league. And here's this classy guy who's brought into his house and he's probably charming the pants off his wife.
And he is.
And yeah, but it you know, his assumptions are still kind of unfounded. It's just it makes perfect sense.
Right.
But his assumptions are still just that, assumptions. And so things get grim towards the end. And I actually really these work best in the last 15 minutes, I thought.
The last bit is totally Cask of Amontillado and a traditional Poe twist kind of to the end of it. Mm. One thing you notice as you go along, and they almost didn't need it, but it's kind of funny when it happens. But Peter Lorre, he's showing you everything you need to know, but he also talks out loud to himself all the time.
Yeah.
And gets in trouble all the time by talking out loud to himself. Like, keep your crazy thoughts quiet, please. Like, if you're in front of the police, play it cool, dude.
Yeah, but you do get the sense that, like, this is insanity coming on. So he's not quite well adjusted to the inner monologue and keeping it inside.
Yeah, his hallucinations are... He talks to them a lot and gives them a lot of attention, which...
Yeah.
Keep that to yourself, dude.
Yeah, when talking to cops. Yeah, one word. Lawyer.
Exactly.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. 'Tis some visitor, I muttered, tapping at my chamber door, only this and nothing more.
Moving on to The Raven from 1963, again, written by Richard Matheson. You mentioned they went for comedy.
Yeah, I put Tales comedy in quotes here, too. Comedy.
Yeah, this was...
not a comedy.
This was not one of the good ones.
No, it wasn't funny to me.
It's supposed to be horror comedy. It is very light on the horror. Yeah. It is even more light on the comedy.
It's very light on the story of The Raven.
Yeah. Yeah, they kind of start off the story with it, and in a sort of drunken stretch, we're supposed to sort of take the Raven in the original story as, how do we arrive at a talking bird?
Yeah, and so, I don't care, talking bird, done. You know what I'm saying? I don't need it to be explained. And you think this, let's think about the cast. We have Vincent Price, we have Peter Lorre, we have Karloff, Hazel Court shows back up, and Jack Nicholson's here.
Yeah, maybe
but
the most out of
nothing can
place.
Help this.
Ah! Oh. I've brought you your goblet of warm milk, Father.
Oh, yes, thank you, my dear.
For an opportunity to go, like, really dark and fun, like, Boris Karloff is unstoppable, but they kind of, they make this whole thing, this sort of lighthearted romp between rival magicians.
Wizards and shit.
Yeah, and with, like, very... crude, rudimentary special effects. It's not especially fun.
It annoyed me a lot.
It's not really funny. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, it's nice to see Jack Nicholson as a young man, but even he is out of place. Apparently him and Lorre did not get along. So
really?
Lorre's impulse to like crack jokes, always at other people's expenses and sort of, you know, take shots. It was all like he didn't like Nicholson, so he was fucking with him.
Oh, wow. Yeah, maybe I'll watch that again thinking of that, but probably not. I'll probably never watch this movie again.
I like that.
Upon my soul.
Never mind your soul. Start concentrating on getting me back to my rightful form.
Your rightful form?
Well, what do you think? I was born this way?
We're going to skip by the Haunted Palace because it's not really a Poe story. They just adapted an H.P. Lovecraft story and slapped on Edgar Allan.
Right. The Haunted Palace comes from a song that Roderick Usher sings in the original Poe story.
Wow. Okay.
It's when he's playing his lute and singing.
Yeah.
Which, thank God they left that part out. There was too much lute playing as it was in the movie. But he sings this poem, and it was a place for Poe to actually insert one of his poems into one of his stories.
Oh.
So that's what's going on there. But then, yeah, Lovecraft ended up making the full story.
When I decided, or just jointly decided with AIP, to do other ones, my next choice was Mask of the Red Death.
The day of their deliverance is at hand.
But Ingmar Bergman's picture, The Seventh Seal, had some elements of Mask of the Red Death in it. And I felt, if I do Mask of the Red Death, people will say I'm copying Ingmar Bergman, even though it was written 100 and some years before Bergman. So I went to The Pit and the Pendulum for my second film, and it wasn't until late in the series that I did Mask. And I finally chose it because I felt it was simply the best of the remaining Poe stories, and I wasn't going to worry about what people thought in relation to Ingmar Bergman.
Moving on to 1964's Mask of the Red Death. This was shot in 5 weeks. It was shot in the UK. It was a screenplay by Charles Beaumont and R. Wright Campbell. We again have Vincent Price, and he's playing a real asshole, and I love him. We have John Westbrook, who is Red Death, who has a very nice voice, a very nice timbre to that
voice. I thought
voice,
he sounded
right?
eerily like Christopher Lee.
He really
does. I thought it was Christopher Lee, and I had to look it up.
So here's the synopsis. A European prince terrorizes the local peasantry while using his castle as a refuge against the Red Death plague that stalks the land. I mean, that's basically it.
Yeah, you mentioned how nasty Vincent Price is, and yeah. it's his character. When he's on screen being nasty, I'm still kind of in a golly shucks, aw,
gee, whiz, totally,
kind of watching him go. It's just like, this is fun. Like, say some more mean
he
stuff.
He kidnaps kind of this girl from the town because everyone's, like, getting sick from the Red Death, and Prospero's wandering through town to belittle the people, I guess. I don't know why he's really doing that.
He's bringing back a guest.
Yeah.
Right? He's been somewhere else.
And he's
kind of
telling them, like, I'm having a party, but you guys can't come. And I'm not also going to give you any food. And they're like, okay. And they're kind of mad about it. And he kidnaps a girl because he likes her red hair. And then...
Well, he spares her dad and her brother.
Well, he keeps them as prisoners.
Right. So the sort of exchange is like, I won't kill them, but you are coming with me.
She kind of agrees to things a little too much for a hostage. What is that?
I think you're victim blaming.
I am victim blaming. What is that when they side with their captors? That's kind of what goes on back and forth in this whole story.
Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, that's what's going on with that.
Happens fast.
It was really fast. But then she like remembers and then she like forgets again. There's a lot going on. He brings her and her father and brother to the house, his big castle house thing, but there's already another lady there.
Yeah, she gets washed and sort of primed.
Yeah, they throw her dirty ass in a bath.
Yeah, and her brother and dad go to the basement to the cells to be tortured, presumably.
I guess they're just hanging out down there, apparently.
I am not without influence and power
against the Red Death. Yes. Yes, it came to the village. Even now, it lays waste the countryside. So you can count yourselves fortunate that you were here in this castle under the protection of Prince Prospero.
The story also combines Edgar Allan Poe's story of Hop Frog, which is the little person and his wife and the sort of tale of revenge.
Right, but the wife is played by a child in this, and then they give her an adult voice.
That was so unsettling.
It was really weird.
You're not ugly to me.
I've come to tell you that there's no need for you to appear at the mask tonight.
I don't understand.
My plans are made. If you will trust me and believe in me, we'll leave this monstrous castle tonight.
Do we dare? The Red Death?
It can be no worse than life here. Believe in me.
I do believe in you.
Because at first we were like, oh, is she a little girl? Oh, she's supposed to be a lady. And then she started talking and I was like, I feel really uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that it serves as a dynamic that, like, you know, we see again in The Exorcist with Reagan speaking in this otherworldly voice. But, and the lip sync is so good. Like, this is better than any Italian movie dubbed in English. Yeah. And it makes it so unsettling that it's actually really distracting from what's supposed to be, you know, this nice relationship between the dancer and the little person performer.
Right. Hop Frog is one of those Edgar Allan Poe stories where when we want to see if we should look for more examples of Poe maybe not being the coolest guy in town, Hop Frog is his short story that kind of makes you think he really liked slavery. And he's siding on the side of slavery at his time in the 1830s because Hop Frog is about a little person who is essentially an object that belongs to someone else.
Yeah.
And he rises up and kills his master. And it's kind of allegory for slavery at that time with Edgar Allan Poe. So, Hop Frog.
It serves as like a B plot for this story. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty effective. It certainly culminates into a pretty wild scene. Should we go into that spoiler of?
I don't know.
If you've ever, well, let's see.
I don't know, Darren. How do we talk about a guy alive in a girl without giving it away?
I will say he has developed an audience of friends who are just willing to go along with anything. And so when a man is literally to death in front of them, just shy of cheering on this crowd.
Everyone's having
a
great time.
Yeah.
I kind of think everyone's on drugs.
I think he's developed a lot of like-minded, you know, sort of royalty one percenters.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. He's a satanic, like, cult leader kind of guy.
Yeah. I didn't really I heard him speak the words and I heard him sort of pledge allegiance to Satan, but it never quite sunk in that, like, that makes him a bad guy.
Yeah, no, I mean, because Juliana, that character is totally into Satan. She burns an upside down cross on herself.
Yeah.
She's like so into it, but she doesn't seem all that bad. She kind of helps the girl and everything too.
Yeah, she kind of has a sort of test of conscience and doesn't pan out so great.
Yeah, no, it doesn't work out good for most anybody in this story. Yeah.
You mentioned the film was made in England, and you have to believe, as an AIP picture, that would only have been the case if they could get a tax break. And
my decision to make the last of the two Poe films, The Mask of the Red Death and The Tomb of Ligeia, in England was not an aesthetic choice. It was a practical choice. The films had been exceptionally successful in the UK, and the UK at that time had something called the Edie Plan, which was a subsidy for English films. And Anglo Amalgamated, the English distributors who had handled the Poe films, suggested that I make the next two films in England, take advantage of the English subsidy, and I could make slightly bigger films for the same price.
That said, the set design on this is particularly good, and they make great use of it with the camera work in this one.
Mm-hmm.
It has been said that Mask of the Red Death had the highest production value of any of the Poe films, and that's probably true. The films we shot in the United States were, of course, low budget and shot in 3 weeks. The shooting schedule on Mask in London was 5 weeks, but as I've said several times, the English crews worked a little more slowly, so I consider it to be 4 weeks, but still it gave us a little more time. But more importantly, the studio we were shooting at had shot a number of classic films, and their scene doc was amazing. Danny Haller, my art director, who was a brilliant art director, and I walked through the scene doc to see what sets had been built for previous pictures, and we found the sets from either Beckett or A Man for All Seasons, and they were wonderful. So we pulled those flats out of the scene, and Danny constructed the sets, building only a small portion of the sets around these wonderful components, and that gave the film a much bigger look.
this really felt like the first time where they could open up on a set, and there's a 360 shot where he's monologuing.
Yeah.
That it's perfection.
Yeah, there's a lot of track shots and long shots that 360s, I don't think probably people had ever seen anything really like that.
My directing style while shooting is to try to be as innovative as I can with the camera without becoming obtrusive. I don't think the camera should set up shots that the audience says, wow, look at that shot. The camera should function to help tell the story. But within that, you can set a mood. I like to use a lot of moving camera positions, move the actors, move the camera, combined with coverage and as interesting composition as I can get, a composition in depth, so that the flat two-dimensional screen gives the effect of a three-dimensional work. Before shooting, however, I'm a strong believer in preparation. My goal always is to sketch out all my shots before shooting. I've never achieved the goal, but I will generally be able to sketch out 70, 80, 90% of the shots, and I will follow that plan 70, 80, 90% of the time. Sometimes the shots I've sketched out don't work. Sometimes I'll get a better idea on the set so that I will modify them. But at least I have a line to follow.
Silence. Listen. Is it to awaken and hear the passing of time?
In this case, we follow Vincent Price monologuing perfectly around the room, and it's beautiful. And mm-hmm. he commands his attention of the whole crowd. It's a fantastic piece of work.
Yeah, this is another story like House of Usher, where Poe really uses this idea of totality. So every single thing that Poe is writing means something. Mm. And in this story, and Corman makes good work of it again, because he's kind of taking on the ideas of Freud.
There was a great deal of Freudian theory behind these films, whether or not that theory comes out, I'm not certain. And maybe it shouldn't. Maybe it should remain subtextual, as it were. Freud's theories were more popular in those days, or more believed than they are now. But I was working with them very intensely.
All the colors make sense. So we have that ballroom, which is a kaleidoscope of colors.
Yeah.
And we take our trip through our journey of colors of rooms, each room having a different meaning. And we end in this black room with red windows. And it's really effective.
Yeah.
It's really effective. We find Prospero early on is kind of seemingly taking a nap on Satan altered time. I don't know what he's doing, but he's taking a nap. And Francesca's kind of the peasant girl is wandering around the house. She's a terrible house guest. She goes there. He's clearly sleeping.
He told her not to go in that room.
Yeah. She kind of looks in his face, and he opens his eyes, and then she screams in his face and runs away. So think that you're Vincent Price and you're taking a nap, and this girl that you've newly captured in your house is over. He screams in your face and runs away.
Yeah. A minute ago, I was worshiping Satan. It's very exhausting, praising the Dark Lord.
I'm tired. Don't come here and scream in my face and run away, bitch.
But speaking of the colors, the dream sequence in this is my favorite by far. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the camera work and the optical work and the lens work. It amounts to a really unsettling dream sequence, which most of the other dream sequences are flashbacks or just kind of, you were witnessing this other thing. This one serves to frighten you.
Yeah, definitely. This is when we see what Juliana's inner kind of turmoil is going on there. Most of that scene was actually cut when it was printed in the UK because they couldn't have it in the show. It showed in America, no problem, and it was put in those, but in the UK they took it out so that it could get released.
Wow, on account of censorship?
Yes.
It was too scandalous?
Yes, it was scandalous.
Wow.
Most of these, had gotten an X in England, but this one they did have to cut a substantial chunk of that flashback out.
Just as a historical side note, the movie was made in 1964, and this took a whopping 5 weeks to accomplish. They had a month and change to get this done. And in that span of time that they were in England is when JFK was assassinated. So I think he talks about being on set and having, on the day of the funeral, they had like a minute silence. But it's strange to think that they came back to a country wholly different than the one they left. Wrapping up, I'll say a little bit about Roger Corman's sort of falling out with AIP. Having made these movies, he originally only wanted to make The House of Usher. That proved too big a success to leave alone. So they continued down the series, and we said they even made one and called it one of the post-cycles. It's not really. Following Mask of the Red Death, they did The Tomb of Lygia, which we might talk about another day. But here's an excerpt from an interview regarding his departure and his starting his own film company. It was clear that there was some juggling of the books on the profit participation. And also, they were starting to cut the films after I made them. In the 60s, I was of the radical group, and they were getting older, and they were getting more conservative as I was becoming more radical. So there was a problem with the profit participation, and there was a problem with them cutting my films after I'd finished them. And I just felt, okay, I want to have my own company. It's strange to think that Roger Corman's career, this really was like the first third.
Right.
But, you know, he marked, you know, American film history. And
right.
His
He's
partnership
very
with
similar
AIP.
To Christopher Lee in that he has done a lot of everything, of all aspects of entertainment business kind of an idea.
So that'll wrap it up for our cycle on Roger Corman's Poe cycle. Join us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Rants Macabre. It is also, our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. Our website is therantsmacabre.com. Drop us a line. We love hearing from you guys. We especially love the ongoing conversations we have on Twitter. If you find us on iTunes, do us a favor and drop us a review. Give us a couple stars here and there.
Yeah.
We're also on Stitcher, Internet Radio, as well as Google Play Music. We've got merch. We've got buttons, magnets, and stickers. You can find those at therantsmacabre.com.
We are on Patreon. So if you want to become a patron of us on Patreon, visit us at patreon.com/rantsmacabre. And we have exclusive content for our Patreon patrons.
If you're feeling charitable, we've also got a donate button. If, you know, consider if you've downloaded, say 20 episodes, drop us a couple bucks.
Yeah. Help get us out of this mouse-infested office.
You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.